From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the recovery movement. Dr. Al Mooney used to have the distinction of being the only sober member of his family. When his parents sobered up, they started a rehab clinic, which Dr. Al now runs. We'll talk with him and his mother about some funny and scary twists their lives have taken. For several years, Al Franken has been affectionately spoofing the recovery movement on Saturday Night Live through his character Stuart Smalley. Stuart is addicted to 12-step programs. Al Franken will tell us how he created Stuart based on his own experiences in 12-step programs. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Merchant Ivory production, The Remains of the Day. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Corey Flintoff. After trading insults over their proposed debate, the White House and Ross Perot agreed that Vice President Al Gore and the Texas billionaire would debate the North American Free Trade Agreement next Tuesday night. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Gore and Perot will face off on CNN's Larry King Live in Washington for 90 minutes. Perot had proposed that the debate be held this Sunday in Tampa, where he already had scheduled an anti-NAFTA rally. But the administration rejected that idea and demanded a more neutral site. In the middle of the negotiations over the time and locale of the debate, Perot accused the White House of trying to wriggle out of the confrontation.
Since I responded, there has been a great deal of scurrying around. There is an absolute fear of facing a huge audience of working Americans.
Now, with the showdown set for Tuesday night, the administration continues its efforts to drum up badly needed votes. The House is expected to vote on NAFTA on November 17th. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Food and Drug Administration has approved the sale and use of a controversial hormone that increases milk production in cows. The hormone is a genetically engineered product that was developed by Monsanto Company more than 9 years ago. FDA Commissioner David Kessler said the government will not require that milk from the treated cows be labeled or identified in any way. The use of the drug will be delayed while the Office of Management and Budget studies the possible reaction by consumers and the impact of the hormone's use on the dairy industry. Critics say that milk is already oversupplied and hormone-enhanced production will drive small farmers out of business. In Malibu, California, the wildfire that blackened more than 18,000 acres and destroyed 350 homes is now more than 70% contained. But the death toll has risen to 3. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
Sheriff's deputies found 2 badly charred bodies in a pickup truck Thursday just before dark. They were later identified as an elderly couple who had lived in the Carbon Canyon area for many years. Their names were not immediately released. The other person killed in the Malibu fire was Duncan Gibbons, a 41-year-old British film director. He suffered fatal burns while trying to rescue a cat. Damage from this fire is estimated at more than $1 billion. Like half a dozen other wildfires that have ravaged Southern California in the past 2 weeks, the Malibu blaze was caused by arson. Sheriff's deputies are investigating, but 2 men seen driving away from the flashpoint of the fire shortly after it began have been eliminated as suspects. 6,000 firefighters are still working to control the blaze. Full containment is expected later today. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The Dow Industrials gained almost 19 points today to close at 3,643. This is NPR. President Clinton attempted to calm fears on Wall Street that the country may be in for another big boost in interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 70 points in 2 days this week in response to gains in long-term interest rates on the 30-year Treasury bond market. The president told reporters that he doesn't expect a big increase in interest rates because there's very little inflation in the economy. He said he believes the increase in long-term bond rates is a result of the improving health of the economy. In South Africa, a large amount of explosives and ammunition has been stolen from a military base in the northern Transvaal. Police say they've arrested 5 white people believed to be members of a militant right-wing group. The BBC's Tom Carver reports from Johannesburg.
The equipment was stolen from an ammunition dump near the town of Pietersburg, one of the most hard-line right-wing areas in the country. It's quite common for the odd gun to go missing from military bases, but hardware on this scale suggests increasing mobilization among the right wing. Last month, the main right-wing alliance, the AVF, called on its supporters to start building up supplies for an armed struggle. Next week's deadline for the end of constitutional talks and the beginning of power sharing between blacks and whites is causing a hardening of attitudes among many right-wingers. Since both the government and the ANC refuse to entertain the idea of a separate white homeland, some whites now appear to believe that fighting is the only alternative left to them and are preparing for this in earnest.
The BBC's Tom Carver reporting. A new study finds that smoking is still the leading cause of fire-related deaths in the United States. The report, released by the National Fire Prevention Association, said that 25% of all fire deaths in homes were caused by cigarettes, cigars, or pipes. In 1991, smoking caused about 9% of all fires. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This may be the ultimate in recovery stories. Dr. John Mooney was a surgeon who was addicted to alcohol and pills. His wife was addicted too. Dr. Mooney kept them supplied with drugs by writing out phony narcotics prescriptions. That landed him in prison, where he sobered up. His wife sobered up too. Soon he turned his practice into counseling alcoholics, and the Mooney's home became a clinic for recovering addicts. The Mooneys had four children, three of whom were still living at home. You'd think the children would never go near drugs and alcohol after that, but three of the four became addicts themselves. Dr. Al Mooney is the child who stayed straight. I'll call him Dr. Al because that's what people call him in Statesboro, Georgia. Dr. Al is now the medical director of Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, the rehab hospital his parents started after they outgrew the clinic in their home. All three of Dr. Al's siblings are sober now and have worked at the hospital. His father died several years ago. Last year, I spoke with Dr. Al and his mother, Dot. Dr. Al told me that growing up in the Mooney house didn't seem so strange at the time.
It was a normal family as far as I was concerned. It was the only family I had ever been a part of, and I really didn't have anything else to compare it to. The first time I really knew that something was wrong, and I could identify that, was when my dad came back in sober, and all of a sudden... Now, I do remember confusion before that point. There was like a void in the family, but I didn't identify where it came from. But when I was 11, he was in a lot of trouble from his drugs, went to the Federal Narcotic Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, and came home sober, and it was like the same body with a different person in it. It was a very strange feeling. And he talked about what had happened. And he was not convinced he was an alcoholic or he was a drug addict, or at least I don't remember that. But one thing that he was convinced of, that there was something outside of us in the family that was responsible for a lot of this, and that he had been told there were some answers to it. Now, that was a relief to me because, in some funny way, as the oldest child in the family, my dad was a doctor, my mom was a nurse, you know, very prominent in the community, and everything was going great. In a crazy kind of way, I had assumed responsibility, at least in my mind somewhere, for what in the family was not happy and fulfilling.
Did your parents try to hide their problem from you? Did they try to pretend like they weren't drunk or they weren't high?
I don't remember there being a lot of alcohol and drugs around. I remember one real bad argument that we had, and it was the strangest argument when I thought about it later on. We were watching TV one night, and I know now they were drunk, but I didn't. You know, the drinks were just around. I didn't recognize that it was alcohol. It was just there were the drinks there. It was a big part of our life, and it was just normal. But one night there was an argument about whether we should go to bed or watch TV. And about halfway through this tremendous argument, my folks switched sides in the argument. And they switched sides a couple of times. And the strangest thing that night, I remember both of them chasing me and my brothers up the stairs, you know, hurting us to our beds like animals almost. And then I remember them fighting that night. But I do associate the confusion, a little abuse, but not a lot. But the alcohol was just mixed in. I didn't know about the drugs until later.
Your late husband was sent to federal prison in Lexington, Kentucky, for writing prescriptions. What were the charges? Exactly?
Abuse of drugs.
Okay, and those were the drugs. I guess you were both taking.
Right, right.
So he sobered up in a federal prison.
Yes.
How did that work for him?
I think it was the only time in his addiction that he had been stopped long enough, which I think is real important. He was there 4.5 months, and he was stopped dead. He could not get out. He could not do anything else, and he had to get involved in a program that helped him stay sober. And then when he came home, I went right along trying to help him. I didn't know I had a problem. See, that one of the most baffling things about this addiction is that we can nearly die and never know we've got it, not know what's wrong. I'd been to psychiatrists for years. I had even had electric shock treatments for years for my nervous disorders, you know, from living with the alcoholic, I thought. I still didn't know I was alcoholic, and I never got diagnosed as an alcoholic or an addict. But you can't when you don't tell the doctors that you drink or take drugs. I'd tell them how much he took, but I didn't ever tell them how much I didn't really know.
So when your husband came back from prison and he had sobered up, you stopped drinking and taking drugs too?
I didn't stop my drugs at that time, but I knew I didn't want him to drink. I was doing it for him. And I stopped drinking. I took my last drink before he came home. But the drugs, I didn't know there was anything wrong with that, and I thought I needed them. I did need them. That is my addiction, the need for them. But I continued that, and I went along with him, with the group we were in, and listened to the people, and I identified with those people, not only other groups, but I identified with the alcoholics and the addicts. And I diagnosed myself. And I haven't had a drink or mood-changing drugs since. And that was straight from the psychiatrist and the electric shock treatments and everything. And there weren't any hospitals then. There wasn't any place to go. All the women got put in the insane asylum. That had a lot to do with me staying sober, too.
Do you think the fact that you and your husband were trying to go through this together made it any easier for you both?
Yes, I do, because he had a start on me and had something to offer me, and he did not allow me in any way to interfere with his sobriety and what he was doing and the program he had going to stay sober. And I am grateful for that now, but I did not like it at the time.
How did he function as a doctor and surgeon, too? Was he a surgeon, too?
I thought he was a surgeon.
Yeah, how did he function as a doctor and a surgeon if he was on drugs and alcohol?
Very well, until the very end. We had a lot of people in our hometown that said they'd rather have John Mooney drunk than any other doctor sober. And, you know, that's not good for an alcoholic either.
Right, because it makes you feel like, hey, I can do this.
That kept him going a long time, you know.
But it's not uncommon at all for an alcoholic to excel and work tremendously hard at their profession, because they know that they're having to overcompensate in an area where their lives has fallen apart or fallen apart.
And I was a great enabler.
How so?
I kept him. You know, we nearly loved each other to death, protecting and enabling each other. I would lie for him. I would do anything. I would give him drugs when he needed them, when he'd go into a hospital and they wouldn't keep him comfortable. I would take the medical bag and I would give him something to keep him comfortable, because they didn't keep him comfortable. And then if you stay with them, you need something too. So I would take care of both of our comfort while he was hospitalized.
Dr. L, when your parents started to sober up, what was it like in the house? Was it initially better or was it more tense?
It was really bizarre. It was a new family, a new life, new people that I had never known before. I'd always known them drunk. I describe myself like a little duckling that cracks out of its shell when, you know, when it's born. My whole life had been imprinted with that alcoholism, and now it was a very strange change that came over our family. And for the first year, maybe two, it was some of the hardest years I remember. I remember some of the, at home, you know, my mom was going through her drug withdrawal, and a lot of the hostility and a lot of the anxiety, all the emotions that she was going through were taken out on, you know, me and my brothers. The only real physical, we never had experienced a lot of physical violence, but I remember to this day, one morning on the way to school, it was like she exploded, and I curled up in a little ball on the front seat, and her fists were pounding me, and we've talked about all those things since and come and gotten okay with them, but it scared me to death. I did know there was something different, and I knew that there was, you know, I could see something that was different. I didn't understand it. It took a lot of years, and at that time, there were no family programs. There was no understanding of addiction, and My folks were gone off to their meetings and running around the country, beginning to take care of drunks. And it was like, well, first they love their booze, now they love their drunks, and where's the family come in?
So it took a while before sobriety seemed like a good thing to you.
Right. You know, I had kind of a love-hate relationship with it at first. But finally, I guess they got sober enough to understand what the family needed, and we began to do things together. Because there wasn't money to have the material gifts that we used to have, we finally got realistic, and my dad paid off the $600 milk bill that he had, and we did without ponies and toys and some of the material things that had appeased us for a while. But we began to take vacations together. The two things I remember doing was going to conventions of people who were also recovering. And also we went camping. We didn't have a lot of money to spend. So we would go up into the mountains and spend the weekends or weeks at a time camping together as a family. And some of those times I'll treasure forever.
Dot, how did you and your husband start doing recovery work and start bringing people into your home, turning your home into a recovery clinic?
Well, you know, one of the things that's best for alcoholism and in the early stage of trying to stay sober, and I think it's important right on, is to help other people who are suffering. That's where I got some help from. And we just began to go places and meet people, and they would end up in our home because he was known as the drunk doctor, you know. Even after he got sober, they called him the drunk doctor because we were a small town, and if they wanted to talk to find him, all they had to do was call the telephone company and ask for the drunk doctor, and they'd always give him the call. They knew who it was, and people started coming in, and there was no place to put them. So we just took them in at home, and it was good therapy for me.
Why?
As well as for them, because we would shell peas and butter beans and cry and, you know, just do all that crazy stuff together. At least I wasn't the only one. I had other people that were crying too, shelling peas and butter beans and doing whatever we had to do. And it was kind of nice, and it became normal for us.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Al Mooney, medical director of the Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia. It's a recovery center for people who have been alcohol or drug abusers. Also with us is his mother, Dot Mooney, who's the co-founder of the hospital and is in charge of women's extended care there. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Dr. Al Mooney and his mother, Dot Mooney. They run a center for recovering addicts in Georgia. Dr. Mooney is co-author of the recovery book. Now, you have three brothers and sisters, right?
Right, two brothers and a sister.
Now, each of them got involved with drugs and alcohol.
Right.
Were you shocked? Were you surprised at all when your siblings started using?
I don't know that I've ever thought about that. That's a good question. And I think early on, I thought maybe they were just kind of playing the role. You know, our family now has an identity that's switched from alcohol to recovery. And I said, well, maybe that's just the way they think they can get their attention. And their love in the family was by confessing they've got an alcoholic, and then the family would give them their, you know, the love that they deserve like all these patients. And Over a period of time, I began to, because when I went to college, we separated from my brothers and sister, and we were not very close at that time. I didn't have very much of a relationship with them. We had been pushed apart by the alcoholism. In the last 15 years, we've gotten extremely close, and we've gone back and talked about those days and become supportive of each other. And I'm amazed at what did happen. They saw all this. They heard all this. And yet the facts in their life involved with alcohol and drugs are so clear that they also had the disease of addiction that it's just irrefutable.
Now, how did you decide that you wanted to be a doctor and follow in the footsteps of your father and his father?
It really never was a decision. That's all I had ever intended to do. It was like I came from six generations of I was a sixth gen. I was going to be the sixth generation of physicians, the third generation in our in our community. I still have a few patients that my granddad delivered. I guess there's probably very few other physicians that have the kind of continuity in medical practice that I have and working with families over generations like this. But it was never a decision. I just knew that was what I was going to do. And I had some stumbling blocks along the way, and I remember being told a couple of times that, you know, people just didn't think I was going to make it. And I said, well, you know, I've got a contingency plan, and I had it all mapped out. And fortunately, it did work out. I was persistent and moved on through my medical education.
When you were studying medicine, did you plan on running a recovery center? Is that what you had in mind?
No, I initially wanted to be a surgeon, you know, like my dad and granddad. And then some strange things happened. See, every alcoholic I had ever known had gotten sober. I had never seen an alcoholic die that I can remember. I'd heard about it. But anybody who ended up kind of in our system or our network lived happily ever after. And I thought that was what happened to alcoholics and drug addicts. And then when I got into a medical training environment, when I got into real medicine, I remember at Emory when I was a medical student, we had a guy that I know now was in barbiturate withdrawal. He was very anxious and nervous. I didn't know what was going on then, except he had told a medical student partner of mine that he had been taking a lot of these drugs. He was shaking and nervous. I came back to rounds the next morning, and he was gone. I said, where did so-and-so go? And they said, he died last night. And another person who was at Grady Hospital, where I was in medical school, had pancreatitis. Came back the next morning, where's so-and-so? Oh, he died last night. And I began to see alcoholics and drug addicts die, and it was a very strange feeling. I said, wow, this is something I can't believe is happening. These people aren't getting help. And then when I got into my surgery residency, we would do very strange things. I remember a patient who had chronic pancreatitis that every time he would go drink, he would go into tremendous bouts of pain and have to come back to the hospital. It was like he had a built-in reaction to alcohol that should keep him sober, and yet he kept drinking. Obviously, he was a bad alcoholic. But our solution to that problem was to take out his pancreas, give him a 95% pancreatectomy, which left him a permanent and irreversible diabetic and allowed him, I guess, to drink himself to death. I never knew what happened to him. And I began to think about what I was doing and what I had seen in my family and wonder, because there was no specialty of addiction in 1974, I began to wonder if maybe there was some way that my family experiences could ever be helpful in my medical career. And about that time, with what had happened at Willing Way, I was beginning to see that maybe there was a niche for a specialty of addiction, and that led to my decision to go into family medicine and then continue my work in the medical school and do a fellowship and then eventually come back to Willing Way as a medical director.
The whole family is involved, right?
Out of my four children, three of them are alcoholic, and three of them are married to alcoholics, and everybody is sober and happy. And that's most unusual. But I think it's great because we all communicate, we understand each other. And, you know, we were talking a little bit ago about what did we do for people. Mm-hmm. I feel that loneliness is one of the biggest things with alcoholics, and the love that they get in recovery, I think is very powerful.
Dot, when your children became alcoholics, did you try to do something to intervene? You had already worked with a lot of alcoholics and drug users. Did you try to use your recovery knowledge to help them, or was it different for you with your children than it was with
other different
people?
I've learned that sometimes the families, we can learn what we can do about ourselves, but we can't stop them from drinking or taking drugs. And I knew that. Fortunately, the two boys just got help on their own. They admitted it, and no confrontation or anything. They just wanted a better way of life, I think. Now, with the daughter, it was a little different. She had many treatments, and a lot of things happened in there. And I had to take a good look at myself because I was into denial about her. I knew it, but I know I didn't want to. And I had some anger about it. And actually, you know, I was enabling her. We both were. And that's something we knew better than to do. But we had to literally let her go and not even come home. And that's hard with your baby, especially my only daughter. But she says that if I hadn't done that, she doesn't think she would have survived. We were, when we cut her off completely, and that's hard. And I feel like I'm glad I was emotionally ready to do it when the time came, because I needed a lot of help during that time. It was really hard.
Let me ask you this. Now that recovery is so such an almost like popular subject for talk shows and books and so on, do you ever worry that, on the one hand, it's really increased awareness and it makes it possible for people to talk about what they've been through without being condemned for it. On the other hand, I know I sometimes feel like we've killed the language, you know, that we've made everything into such a cliche that it's hard to talk about this kind of thing,
right,
and still sound, still have the words carry the full impact of the emotion and the pain and so on.
Right. We've dressed it up so until it doesn't sound so bad. And that's why I still call myself, and people laugh at me about this, I call myself a dope fiend, because that's what it was 31 years ago when I came in. And I didn't like that. That was a bad, bad, bad word. And codependency, you know, that's a word that's become real popular. And, some places you don't seem to be in unless you've been in treatment for codependency. Well, I call it sick dependent. You know, being dependent on a member of the family is fine. But that sick dependency, I had gotten so sick with my alcoholism and addiction and was so insecure and so fearful of losing my husband that I wanted to die too. And me with three children, and that's sick, you know. And I still use those words that don't sound too good, because I worked hard to get rid of those, that stigma. And I was the only woman I knew in Statesboro that was alcoholic, except one that I knew that said she was. But, you know, I'd been through all of the route of shock treatments, electric shocks. I know all about living better electrically and learned all that. And that just didn't do it. It was not treatment for my addiction. Nobody knew I had it. But it sure did keep me alive until I found something that I could use for recovery.
I think, in regard to the jargon and the movement of recovery, it's interesting that often when a new intellectual area develops or a new scientific area develops, one of the first things to come along is a new language for it. And often when we know the least about the scientific area, the language and the vocabulary embellishes it in maybe an excess. Dermatologists, you know, we don't know where a lot of skin rashes come from, but if you've ever been to a dermatologist, you'll feel really great when you leave the office, because you have all these long words of what the rash was, and basically it all means the same thing. You know, they don't really know, but they describe the rash as it looks. And I think a lot of what we've heard in the recovery movement is just that. There's a lack of familiarity with this new emotional understanding, and people try to put it into traditional intellectual slots. And that creates a difficulty that comes out in fancy language and fancy words. And what I believe, and the longer I've worked in this field, the less necessary it is to use a lot of those fancy words. I can talk about love and hate and hunger and being drunk and high, and you don't have to use a lot of the fancy words that you hear.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
Great to share anything we can about this.
Dr. Al Mooney and his mother Dot Mooney recorded last year. Their rehab center, Willing Way Hospital, is located in Statesboro, Georgia. The Mooneys know the value of the recovery movement, but they could live without the jargon. Ditto for Saturday Night Live's Al Franken, who's come up with perhaps the best satire of movement jargon through his character Stuart Smalley. We'll hear from Franken in the second half of this archive edition of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He's good enough, he's smart enough, and doggone it, people like him. He's Stuart Smalley, and he's addicted to 12-step programs. Coming up from our archives, an interview with Al Franken about creating the character of Stuart Smalley for Saturday Night Live. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Remains of the Day, the new film starring Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Vice President Al Gore and one-time presidential contender Ross Perot have agreed to meet and debate the North American Free Trade Agreement Tuesday evening in Washington. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
After a day of trading barbs and taunts, the Texas billionaire blinked. Perot first had insisted that Gore debate him in three separate sessions in front of big rallies he'd already scheduled. The rallies would presumably draw lots of Perot supporters. And the White House balked. Although Al Gore had initially said he'd debate Perot anywhere, anytime, the vice president said today he wanted to meet Perot in a neutral setting, with the format controlled by talk show host Larry King. Perot accused the White House of being afraid to come before real people, but in the end, he backed down, and a debate was scheduled for the Larry King live show on Tuesday at 9 p.m. There will be no audience. This high-risk White House strategy is a measure of how difficult it's been for the president to convince members of Congress to stand with him on the NAFTA vote. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Haiti, talks on restoring ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power have been called off when military officials did not attend the meeting. Failure of the Haitian military to step down as agreed upon in a UN plan may lead to expanded sanctions. There is already a UN-imposed oil ban on the island. In Washington, State Department officials said that they regretted the failure of the Army commander to attend the talks today, and said that the Clinton administration is considering additional steps that it might take with other nations. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a controversial drug for cows that will boost milk production. The FDA said the drug, known as BST, is safe for cows who get it and people who drink their milk. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
Activists have opposed BST because some small farmers worry that big farms will profit most from increased milk production and drive the small operators out of business. Others object because the drug is genetically engineered. FDA Commissioner David Kessler said there's no evidence that the drug harms people or animals in any way. In fact, Kessler says it's impossible to tell whether milk has been produced with the help of this drug, so dairy products won't even have to be labeled. The FDA didn't consider economic issues, such as the effect the product may have on small farmers. That's outside the agency's purview. But BST won't be available immediately because Congress has voted for a 90-day ban on the use of the drug, ostensibly to give the federal government time to study its impact on farmers and consumers. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The government says that consumer borrowing climbed by 10.5% in September for the biggest increase in nearly 6 years. The Federal Reserve says that credit for new cars was up 10.2%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 18 points to close at 3,643. This is NPR News. Officials of the Clinton administration have announced that Nashville and Raleigh-Durham have been tentatively chosen as gateways for American Airlines service to London. A final ruling will be made after public comments on the two locations. This new direct service is expected to start April 1st. The nation's economy added 177,000 jobs in the month of October, but the unemployment rate edged up from 6.7% to 6.8%. NPR's John Itzty reports.
A surge in the number of people looking for work, which surpassed the number of new jobs available, pushed the unemployment rate up. But despite the increase in unemployment, the October figures are seen as a positive report. Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner Catherine Abraham said the data indicates the labor market continues on its recent path of modest improvement. The 177,000 jobs added to payrolls is better than the average for this recovery, but below historic patterns. Most of the increase was in the service sector. One positive sign is that the number of manufacturing jobs also increased for the first time since February. After losing 250,000 jobs already this year, manufacturing finally added 12,000 jobs in October. That's a sign that recovery may be moving onto firmer ground. But employers still seem cautious about hiring. They're giving current factory workers record amounts of overtime. I'm John Idstein, Washington.
In Southern California, two bodies have been found in burned-out areas near the coast, raising the death toll from fires to three. Fire officials say that a 19,000-acre fire along the coast is now more than 70% contained. Winds have continued to be calm today, helping out those fighting the blaze, and one official said that weather is not a factor as of now. Over the last 10 days, wildfires have destroyed more than 1,100 homes and burned some 200,000 acres. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The 1980s may have been the Al Franken decade, but the 90s belonged to Stuart Smalley. Al Franken has been associated with Saturday Night Live for many years as a writer, performer, and co-producer. Over the past few years on the show, he's been satirizing the recovery movement through his character Stuart Smalley. Smalley is a caring nurturer who is addicted to 12-step programs and dispenses advice on how to keep a positive attitude. I spoke with Franken last year after he finished his book of Stuart's daily affirmations and created an audio tape of his guided visualizations. They're both called I'm Good Enough, I'm Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like Me.
I'm going to do a great guided visualization tape, and I'm going to help people because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. Hello, I'm Stuart Smalley, and welcome to You're Good Enough, You're Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like You, a healing journey through the dysfunctional forest and other guided visualizations. It's a long title, but that's okay. It's appropriate. Now, before we go any further in this tape, I do want to start with a little warning. Guided visualizations are powerful stuff, and hopefully the visualizations on this tape will transport the you inside of you, or whatever, and free that inside person to be the best you inside of you that you can be. But I think I would be remiss if I did not tell you that I am not a licensed therapist, and while I am being paid to do this, I am not a professional in the therapeutic sense. And I do worry that I will misuse this power and really screw somebody up, you know, accidentally. So, while the whole point is to relax and surrender yourself to the tape so that you can be transported to a healing place, just keep an eye out, and you know, if you're beginning to freak or something, you know, just pull out. Okay, I'm beginning to think this was a mistake, the warning. The whole point is to feel safe, and I think this is just scaring people. Can we cut the tape?
Why don't we start with you running through some of the many 12-step programs that Stuart Smalley has been in?
Okay, Stuart is in five. OA, because he's powerless over food, and it's Overeaters Anonymous. Al-Anon, first ACOA, I guess, Adult Children of Alcoholics. As Stuart says, my father is an active alcoholic, a big stinking drunk. And he's in Al-Anon, which is for family members of alcoholics. Thanks again, Dad. Then he's in Debtors Anonymous. I'm a anorexic spender. I have difficulty spending money on myself, as you can see from this sweater. I'm sorry, this is radio. And he is in CODA, which is Codependence Anonymous. It covers a lot of the same area, you know, material as Al-Anon, and I get more out of Al-Anon. But you know, if you get more out of CODA, good for you. Whatever.
Now, how did you come up with the kind of whiny voice that you use for the character?
You know, the voice, it's funny. Sometimes when you write something, it comes with a voice, and this just did. And I don't know why exactly, other than maybe there are a few people. I actually belong to one of those groups. I belong to an anonymous fellowship for friends and family members of drunks or recovering alcoholics, too. And I think there were a number of people in rooms that I've met who sort of remind me of Stuart. And I guess the reason I came up with Stuart and the way he is that one of the great things I learned going to this fellowship is that I can learn stuff from people who I never in a million years thought I could. And so I sort of deliberately made Stuart pretty, you know, pretty silly and lame in a lot of ways, but very kind of courageous and sweet and vulnerable in his own way.
I think that's one of the things I really love about the character, is that you do kind of have it both ways. You know, it's like really funny and you're really mocking the character, and at the same time you could tell you have a real kind of affection and caring for him too.
Well, actually, people who know me very well know that there's a lot of Stuart inside of me. A lot of the insecurity and a lot of the self-doubt and all that stuff. And I think it's in a lot of people. And part of one thing Melody Beattie, who wrote the preface to the book, she wrote Codependent No More. One of the things we were discussing early what she was going to write, and she said something about the book giving people the permission, giving themselves the permission to have the Stuart inside of them.
Oh, and thanks.
I thought that was really nice, because I think there are parts of all of us that are very vulnerable and very, you know, can be stupid at times. And mm-hmm. I think it's okay, you know, it's fine to give yourself permission to do that and not, you know, beat yourself up.
How do you deal with some of the language of the recovery movement, which you mock a lot, but also probably have some respect for, too? Like Stuart's always saying, you know, that, well, this isn't my best show, but that's okay.
Right.
So there's all this, like, affirmation in the language.
Well, affirmations are, I mean, first of all, a program has this incredible amount of jargon.
Yeah.
And the jargon is usually just a shorthand for some concept. So all it really is just a way for someone to grasp, hold on to a concept. And most of these concepts are pretty sound. And so, but the jargon can get pretty grating and silly. And yet, when the concept has helped you so much and the way you got to the concept was through the jargon, you kind of hold on to the jargon. So that's Stuart is a program junkie, so he is a jargon junkie. So actually, people send me these things. I got one the other day, which is, fear is a dark room where negatives get developed. Which is a gift through the mail. So if you're listening and you got good ones, send them to me. Stuart will use them.
What are some of your other favorites?
Another one someone sent to me was, it's easier to put on slippers than to carpet the entire world.
Yes, I like that a lot.
And there's one I'm doing that I heard in program that I'm using this week, because Stuart is going to be on the show this week. He's apologizing for yesterday's show, which is what he always does, and he evidently took Madonna's inventory, and he says, this is a good thing to remember. He says, when you're pointing a finger at someone else, remember there are three fingers pointing back at you.
We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Al Franken, writer and performer on Saturday Night Live. Now, tell me your reaction to this aspect of the recovery movement, the people who say humor is a good recovery tool.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stuart believes that.
Yeah.
he says, one of the affirmations is, today I will laugh at least once. And I've already laughed today, so I'm fine.
There are some people in the recovery movement who really do believe that humor is good therapy. So although they are humorless themselves, they have taught themselves like little jokes and little ways to be humorous. And they're very proud of it. And it's mm-hmm. a kind of like prescription for their health. Do you come across people like that? And I wonder how you react to them and how they react to you.
Well, you know, that's funny. As you said that, it's true. And it's the first time I've realized that, which I can't believe that's the first time I realized that. Thank you for no, it is true. There are people who I, because there are laughter in these rooms. By the way, there's much, I've gone to some open AA meetings, and there's a lot more laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous than in Al-Anon, which is really unfair if you think about it. But, no, there are, you're absolutely right. There are people who, just by nature, have no sense of humor, but know that it's a good thing and are working on it. and it's a really, really ugly thing to observe. But I, you know, God bless them. But there are actually some very, very funny people in these. Actually, you know, the people have a preconception of people who go in the program, and it's just, you know, it's kind of wrong. But there are, some are thicker than others. So you'll be in a room, and some will be thicker than others.
I think one of the really funniest Stuart Smalley sketches that you did for Saturday Night Live was about the genocide of the Kurds right after the war in the Gulf. Why don't I play an excerpt of this?
Hello, I'm Stuart Smalley. I've had a hard time focusing on myself this week, because I've been so upset about what's happening in Iraq to the Kurds. It has been just a horrendous week for them. And so today, I have decided to share my experience, strength, and hope with any Kurds who might be watching. First of all, when I've had a bad week, I try to recite, to remember to recite the Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Now, you are a Kurd. Can you change your situation? Probably not. It's out of your control. But what can you change? Your attitude. You are angry, and that's okay. You're entitled to your anger. You're angry at President Bush because he urged you to rebel against Saddam Hussein, and then he abandoned you. He made a mistake, which is okay. President Bush is not perfect. He's a human being. Human beings make mistakes. And you're angry at Saddam Hussein, who is a very sick person, who obviously hates himself and is taking it out on you.
Al Franken, what gave you the idea of viewing genocide in the language of the recovery movement?
This actually, in your introduction to that, it was the first time I've heard genocide and funniest in the same sentence. I guess it's just that, you know, recovery as said from earlier in the interview, I believe recovery works. It just has its limits. And Stuart is a character who is a recovery addict, and his whole life is seen through the prism of recovery. So he just wanted to comfort the Kurds, and it was sort of meant to sort of highlight the limit of recovery. And also, it's really one of the concepts that I have a tough time with in recovery is a higher power and turning your will over to the higher power. Because as I'm Jewish and I was born in 1951, and I had sort of the Holocaust pounded into my head. And so it's always very hard for me to sort of turn my will over to a loving higher power who could have allowed that to happen. So, but again, higher power in the program is how you've come to understand him. And I work on that. So to me, what was happening to the Kurds that week was one of those, one of those historical events which makes me doubt the existence of a benevolent higher power.
Now, have you met John Bradshaw, one of the heroes of the recovery movement?
You know, I have. I was talking to him about doing something together, and that thing's on hold right now. But we actually did discuss, humor and recovery and the fact that if he did something with me, he might be criticized and that kind of thing. But he just said that, some people are at a more advanced stage of recovery than others, and that there are people don't think stuff is funny. But I have run into very, very little of that, really.
So what would you be doing with John Bradshaw?
Well, in the book, there's a little section where Stewart goes to the National Shame Conference to speak, and he feels like a fraud because all the other speakers there are recovery professionals, and Stewart, you'll remember, is not a licensed therapist. So Stewart actually kind of feels ashamed to be at the National Shame Conference. And he speaks there, and he's sort of over-prepared in a lot of ways. He has, like, slides and tapes and film and stuff like that. And it just becomes a disaster, and he runs off stage and cries and stuff like that. And John Bradshaw comforts him in the book. I was talking to HBO about doing this as a little episode.
Yes, he writes, "I forgot to tell you, John Bradshaw is the featured speaker at the conference. Somebody pinch me."
Yeah, he's Stewart to some extent is a Bradshaw wannabe. Bradshaw is his hero.
I can imagine that if you were at a fellowship meeting, and somebody got up and wanted to say, I'm upset, but I have a right to my anger, that they wouldn't be able to say it because it would sound so absurd after having heard Stuart Smalley say it.
There are people who have said to me that after, and these are people who enjoy the character, who are in recovery, who say that they do feel a little stupid saying some of the things they've heard Stuart say. But I think that might be, I don't think that's bad.
Al Franken is a writer and performer on Saturday Night Live. Our interview was recorded last year. His book and tape are called I'm Good Enough, I'm Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like Me. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we're taking a look at this whole NAFTA debate that is about to begin and the mini-debate between Ross Perot and all comers that the Clinton administration has finally decided to take on. Mara Liasson is going to explain it all to us. We also have the extraordinary story from Maine of the order given to teachers not to resuscitate a student in their class if anything should happen to her. We have a piece with Tom Jelton, who has called us. He's still in Sarajevo and gives us a fill on what has been happening there. The Cirque du Soleil has been here, and Noah Adams has been to it, and he'll have a piece on that.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Producer Ishmael Merchant, director James Ivory, and screenwriter Ruth Prohar Jabvala are the world's longest-running filmmaking team, and just recently they've become one of the most successful. Their hit film of Howard's End won 3 Oscars last year. Their latest movie boasts 2 stars of Howard's End, Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins, in an adaptation of Kazuo Ishiguro's Booker Prize-winning novel The Remains of the Day. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see how the new film measures up.
The scene is Darlington Hall, one of those slightly mysterious mansions in the fragrant English countryside. But instead of examining the family that lives there, The Remains of the Day focuses on the butler, Stevens. Anthony Hopkins plays him as the most perfect, punctilious creature in the world. And it's really an astounding performance. Hopkins draws his head down into his shoulders like a tortoise, and his stiffness, his halting speech, and his twitchy abstraction create the kind of character who forces himself to examine every gesture or utterance before releasing it into the world. That exactitude and reserve have taken their toll. Stevens is more manservant than man. And the only hint we get that his heart may be made of something warmer than polished silver is in the respect he has for his father. Stevens gets him hired at Darlington Hall as an underbutler. Then along comes someone new, a sprightly young housekeeper named Miss Kenton, played with her usual subtlety and wit by Emma Thompson. Miss Kenton takes a shine to Stevens, but when she enters his chambers one day to bring him some flowers, the reception she gets takes her by surprise.
If you like, Mrs. Stevens, I could bring in some more cuttings for you.
Thank you, Miss Kenton. But I regard this room as my private place of work, and I prefer to keep distractions to a minimum.
Would you call flowers a distraction, then, Mr. Stevens?
I appreciate your kindness, Miss Kenton, but I prefer to keep things as they are. Oh, and since you are here, there is a matter I wanted to mention to you, just a small matter. I happened to be walking past the kitchen yesterday morning, and I heard you calling to someone named William. May I ask who it was you were addressing by that name?
Why, Mr. Stevens, I should think I was addressing your father.
Oh.
There are no other Williams in this house, I take it?
True. May I ask you in future, Miss Kenton, to address my father as Mr. Stevens? And if you are speaking of him to a third party, you may wish to call him Mr. Stevens Sr. to distinguish him from myself. So I would be most grateful to you, Miss Kenton.
That's a beautifully built scene, and the remains of the day is full of them. Painful scenes that dig at Stevens the way Miss Kenton does, and eventually hit the same brick wall. The film takes place mostly in the 30s, and the Merchant Ivory team has lavished all its skill on the settings and music and decor. The atmosphere is tuned so precisely to the rhythms of Stevens' routine that late in the story, when he accidentally breaks a wine bottle, it feels like a little apocalypse. And yet something is missing in this movie, something big. Ishiguro's novel was a tour de force. It was told by Stevens himself, and gradually, as you learned all about butlering, you also came to realize that Stevens was an unreliable narrator, a kind of liar. In fact, that lying was an integral part of his butler's personality. He cleaned up the mess in his story, just as he cleaned up the mess in his master's life. And as the novel unfolded, that mess became all too apparent. His master, played in the movie by James Fox, was a Nazi sympathizer. That element is in the movie, too, but it takes a backseat to the central romance. In other words, to Miss Kenton's unsuccessful pursuit of Stevens, which, unfortunately, doesn't work on the screen. The movie never convinces you that someone as lively and alluring as the character Emma Thompson has created would fall so hard, and finally so tragically, for someone as crabbed and chilly as Stevens. I do recommend The Remains of the Day, but with one reservation. As beguiling and beautifully made as this movie is, it has a hole in its heart.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Chris Fraley, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jean Genet was a thief and a vagabond who came to be known as one of the great figures of 20th century literature. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Edmund White about his new biography of Genet. And we talk with one of the pioneers of pop art, Roy Lichtenstein. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.